This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Well, it's nice to see so many people here today. Did you? Okay, yeah. I think it was April 22nd. I just found out about it yesterday, so it didn't do me much good. But I don't have cable either. Ram Dass was on Oprah. Anybody know who Ram Dass is? Remember
yes.
him? Timothy Leary? LSD? You know, and who would have ever thought Ram Dass would have been that mainstream in 2012? It's just amazing. I'm not sure what he said, but I'm sure he said it as well as he could. You know. A couple weeks ago, I was invited to go to All Saints Episcopal Church in Beverly Hills and give a talk on compassion. They're studying a book, 12 Steps of Compassion, written by an ex-Catholic nun. And she uses Buddhism and many other religions to describe and explain what compassion is and how to do it. And they wanted a Buddhist perspective, and so they asked me if I would speak to them. And it was really nice. I haven't been to Beverly Hills in a long time. And you can find parking, you know. It was there. And it's an old church, 1925. Everybody was, like, really nice, which was... I don't know why I should be surprised, but they were really nice. And we had food, and then I gave my talk. And just to give you a soundbite of what I talked about, loving kindness, which I talked about here, but we could change that and go love through kindness, and then compassion would be the activity of kindness. And so that was my whole talk. You didn't even have to go. And it's like, okay, if my love never manifests through mouth or action, does it do anything for anybody, even yourself? So until it manifests in the world through it, some kind of action, I don't think it's compassion. So a woman asked me, she said, I had to put one of my pets down because it was really sick. And what would a Buddhist say about killing your pet? Well, we don't, you know, usually you don't call it killing your pet. You call it, you know, putting it to sleep, helping it transition, you know, things of that sort. And I tell you what, a couple years ago, I would have said absolutely not. You would never, ever kill your pet. Because the first precept is not to take life. And even if it suffers for 2 years, you see, you can rationalize, according to the Theravada tradition, the early Buddhist tradition, that it's working through its karma. All this suffering is purifying its karma for its next rebirth. And maybe it'll even come back as a human being if it's suffered enough as a cat or a dog. Well, you know... then you have to deal with your pet, if you have a pet, and then you sort of wonder, well, is this just a philosophy or a theology? Does it really work? Do you want to watch your pet suffer for 2 years and think it's the right thing to do? And again, in early Buddhism, they don't give you a break. They say that, no, you have to let it die naturally. Okay, but now we come to one... B.C. or A.D., and we have the Mahayana tradition, and we have the religion of Buddhism, not simply the therapy of Buddhism. And now what they say is, well, you know, maybe it's okay to let your pets die. And maybe it's okay to help them die. And maybe it's okay to put them to death, because the first bodhisattva vow is sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. And so what are we saving them from? And the answer would be, we're saving them from suffering. We're not saving them in any other way. Now, Christ does that, but we just save them from suffering. And in saving them from suffering, would it be appropriate to put them to sleep if they're suffering? And I'm thinking, absolutely. So of the three pets that have died in the last year that I've taken care of, one died naturally and two were put to sleep. Now, I couldn't do it myself. I couldn't take them to the vet myself because I cry too much. I just cry all day long. So the residential manager took the animals to be put to sleep. He doesn't cry at all. So it works out fine. And then the last cat that died is now buried in the garden, in the backyard. And I made it specifically known to the residential manager, don't leave the animal there at the vet, because they might do weird things to the body. They might sell it, they might, I don't know, not treat it respectfully. So we're going to bury it in the garden. And every time the flowers come up, we can think of Autumn, the old cat that died. And so it really dawned on me that absolutely, if our pets are suffering, we do need to do something about it. And in this newsletter I sent out a couple days ago, there was this woman, and she cares for animals. She's a veterinarian, and she was really angry at all us Buddhists for letting our animals suffer so much. She couldn't figure out what's wrong with the Buddhists. You know, they just let animals die, and they give them pain pills maybe, and they might do this and that, but those poor animals. So, we all have to figure it out ourselves, of course. And if you're sort of prone to letting the suffering purify the animal, absolutely. And if you want to be a bodhisattva and help all sentient beings end their suffering, you know, maybe we need to kill them. But in a kind, compassionate way. And then wish them a good rebirth. After getting rid of that confusion on my part, I decided to talk today about the Buddhist birthday. Because April and May, every Buddhist temple in LA and around the country is celebrating the birth of the Buddha. And the Japanese start really early. They start in April because they change their calendar from lunar to solar, and so the days change, so they're like first. You know? So all the other Buddhist sects get to go and celebrate with the Japanese, and then the Vietnamese have theirs, and they invite all the monks. Just last week, Saturday and Sunday, they had a giant Buddhist birthday celebration in Westminster Mall in the parking lot. And it was huge, and they had the food booth set up, and they had the carnival rides over here, and they had the stage with entertainment. And they had invited me to give a Dharma talk. I didn't want to do it particularly, but a woman arranged for me to go there, and she had a tent set up, and I was going to give a Dharma talk in English. That was the big draw, Dharma talk in English. Well, most of the people there were Asian, and probably didn't care too much about hearing a Dharma talk in English. And so it was like me and five people who spoke English. And the background was the rides and the food and the entertainment all amplified to 11. And there was just no way to even think, let alone talk, about Dharma. And so I respectfully left after 15 minutes, and everybody else went and got food and had a good time. But I realized the Buddha's birthday was really a celebration. It's a time to have fun and celebrate. The Dharma is like really serious medicine. This is the stuff that you use when times are tough and it's not going the way you think it's supposed to be going. And they didn't need me to give a talk there that day. And then they had over 200 monks the next day on Sunday, and they all lined up and they had their begging bowls. And in their begging bowls, they just went by all the lay people, and the lay people put money in the begging bowls. And some of the monks and nuns got a couple $100, and some got $150, and it was just all this money just overflowing out of the begging bowl. How cruel is America? You know, we don't even feed the monks. We just give them money. You know? So I missed that part. I was there the day before. I didn't get anything. But that's my life, you know? And I thought to myself, okay, well, what are we celebrating? What is the point of the Buddha's birthday? I mean, what did he do that was so cool? Well, if you read the Buddha's birth story, he was born in a really unique way. And some people will poo-poo it and say, no, it's just all myth and legend and nobody is ever born that way. And that's absolutely the case. But it allows us to remember the story because it's so otherworldly. You know, it's like watching a good movie. This was the drama 2,500 years ago. They embellished this birth. So the Buddha's birth mother, Queen Maya, had a dream. And in this dream was a white elephant that had 6 tusks. And because she had that dream, she knew she was pregnant. And her husband bought it. And there you go. And so 10 months later, it was a little different 2,500 years ago, she had a baby. And she had a baby in a asala grove. An asala tree is a beautiful tree with this wonderful flower. And it said to support herself, she reached up and held on to the asala tree. And the Buddha, to be, Siddhartha, was born out of her side. And took 7 steps. And each step he took, a lotus flower blossomed. And he pointed to the heavens, and he pointed to the earth, and said, I am ruler over all. And if you go to a Buddha's birthday celebration, there's a little baby Buddha. He's pointing up, and he's pointing down. Well, you know, it didn't stop there. 7 days later, his birth mother died, Queen Maya died. And it was actually a blessing that she died, because she was getting her reward early. She went right to heaven, you know? And her sister took over, raising Siddhartha. And her sister was also married to the king. So the king married like a lot of women. And it just happened he married these 2 sisters. And so Prajapati took over, raising little Siddhartha. And little Siddhartha was just not your average kid. He was really special because he had had at least 550 rebirths before as a bodhisattva, getting ready for his final rebirth as Siddhartha, later to become the Buddha. And it said there was a plowing festival, and he was just a little rascal, and he had his milk maidens and little nurses watching him, and they sat him underneath the shade of an apple tree, a rose apple tree. And then the nurses sort of left for a little bit because they were having so much fun. It was like the Buddha's birthday celebration that I was at. And little Siddhartha, because he was in the shade of this tree and had been in practice as a bodhisattva for 550 lifetimes, went into a deep state of meditation and entered the first jhana right there on this blanket underneath the tree. Now, nobody saw it because they were all playing and having a good time at the plowing festival. The first jhana is like really important because that's the 4 of them in the form and 4 in the formless. But the 4 form, the 5 aspects of the first jhana are applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. And so those 5 characteristics arose in Siddhartha as he sat there. Astrologers came and took a look at him. You know, remember when Christ was born, they had the 3 wise men and that kind of stuff? Well, we, in Buddhism, they had the astrologers come. And astrologers looked at him, and they knew something was up with this guy, little Siddhartha. And they said, he's either going to be a world monarch, or he's going to be a Buddha, a great spiritual teacher. And one of the astrologers started to cry. And the king said, why are you crying? And he said, because I'm going to be dead soon and I won't see and be able to hear the teachings of this Buddha. And sure enough, he died before Siddhartha became the Buddha. So, you know, the writing was on the wall. This little guy was either going to rule the world or become a Buddha. And his father wanted him to become a ruler, And so he really prevented him from seeing, you know, all the harsh realities of life. You know, and it was like probably a movie set, if we were to go to a movie set, and there weren't any old people, and there weren't any sick people, there weren't any dead people, and everybody had enough to eat and nice clothes to wear and was happy. But then it goes in the story, one night, Siddhartha happened to wake up, and it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and all those maidens that had given him so much pleasure and happiness by playing instruments and singing to them and being beautiful were asleep, and they were snoring, and their mouths were open, and Siddhartha sort of freaked out and said, where did all the beauty go? You know, the illusion of beauty. And he thought to himself, maybe there's more to life than just this stuff. Maybe there's something really happening out there that I haven't seen yet, that I've missed. And it said he went out into the streets of the city with his charioteer Chana, and he saw the four sights. He saw the old person, the sick person, the dead person, and the holy person. And he didn't choose the religious life because of the old person, sick person, or dead person, it said. He chose the religious life because of the holy person. The holy person, for some reason, in the midst of all this pain and suffering, seemed to be unaffected and relaxed and accepting of this birth and death, this constant birth and death going on. I was talking to Holly just as I came in, we're talking about Bambi. You know, Disney has that new movie, Chimpanzee, that came out, and I really would like to go see it, but I pretty much don't want to go see any more animal movies. Because I always get really sad. You know, animals, they don't do much, really. You think about it, what do? They eat and they sleep. They have sex, they kill, and they play, and they're pretty confused. And like, that's their life. You know, and all they do all day is those things, you know? And they're always ready to kill each other. You know, have you ever noticed that? They will never take the first precept, animals. They couldn't do it. They're either protecting their territory, protecting themselves, protecting their family, or they're hungry. And if you're in their way, you're a goner, you know? And you go to the Disney Channel, and you go to the Nature Channel, and you go to the National Geographic Channel, and they have all these cameras set up, and at night, and the aardvark goes out and finds a termite mound and eats 100,000 termites. And all of us might look at that and go, well, those termites, you know, what's a termite? But they just wanted to live, too, until the aardvark came. And now they're dead because they're food. You know, and it's just, it's really sad to see so much death and destruction in the world. The Buddha saw the same thing. He saw that death and destruction. And he said, maybe there's a way that humans can live without participating in that way. And the very first precept that a Buddhist takes would be the precept to avoid taking life. To avoid taking life. And we can pretty much do it. We can't do it 100% because we have to eat. And so far, the chemists haven't come up with a chemical concoction that will allow us to survive. The Hostess Twinkies are pretty close, you know. Until they do, we're going to have to eat something. And some very enlightened people will eat vegetables and plants, you know, and some less enlightened people will go to In-N-Out Burger, and it's just the way it goes. And so we're eating all these things, and we don't really see the cow in the In-N-Out Burger. What we see is the burger, huh? But if we could see the cow, would we eat it? In the filet mignon, you know, or the New York cut? You know how they have all these euphemisms, you know, for the cow and parts of the cow? If you could actually see the cow, would you eat it, you know? You go to Kentucky Fried Chicken, get a little chicken leg, you know? It looks like a little chicken leg. And there you are. And I can remember years ago, one of the joys of life for me was to go and get a rotisserie chicken from Vaughn's and never use a fork or a knife, but just tear the thing apart. You know, and it was almost like I was going back to, you know, when humans began, and I was just ripping it apart, and my face was all, and it just was so satisfying. But then as you get your spiritual practice going, you realize that that's pretty much going against everything you're trying to do. And what you're trying to do is live in harmony in a world that has birth and death occurring moment by moment all the time. So here is this guy, Siddhartha, who has become aware of this. And because of the suffering, he was aware of in himself and in others. He decided to see if he could do something about it. Now, I imagine he petitioned all the gods of India to step forward and end human suffering. And not one of the gods of India did it. And when I talk to my Catholic friends about suffering, suffering is good. It makes you a better person. There's a purification aspect to suffering. And when I give talks in Catholic high schools, you know, Christ is on the wall, on the cross. And, you know, for the Buddhist guy to walk into the room and see Christ on the cross and talk about the end of suffering, it's an odd, you know, paradox, perhaps. So, did the Buddha sense there was suffering in the world? I don't think so. I think what the Buddha said is the world is just the way it's supposed to be, but because of the way humans experience the world, they suffer. And so maybe he didn't need to change the world at all, the Buddha. Maybe he didn't need to change the world at all. What he needed to do was change the way humans experience the world, because they were experiencing the world in an unrealistic way. And that's why I have come to the conclusion that early Buddhism, the Theravada tradition, is a therapy. It's not a religion. The Buddha never became a Buddhist. He was happy being a Brahmin or a Hindu or whatever you want to call him, and he never became anything else. But what he did is he created this therapy that allowed us to transform the way we experience the world, therefore not having to suffer. Okay, very cool. And he did it within 6 years. He transformed his own consciousness in 6 short years and 550 lifetimes before. And now he's the Buddha. He's one who is awake. And he's walking and talking, and people know there's something different about this guy, because he just isn't your average guy. Never was, never was going to be. He was a special kind of guy. Apparently had this aura, too, that's colorful. People could actually see it, you know? And they would ask him, who are you? Are you a god? Are you a deity? Are you an angel? And he would say, no, I am one who has woke up. I'm awake. And in waking up, it probably wasn't, you know, a big sell. You know, because people were probably hungry and they had families. And do you want to wake up? Well, I woke up this morning, you know, and life still sucks, you know. So, so he had to really figure out how he was going to sell this to people, you know. And he said, are you getting tired of suffering? And, you know, everybody suffers all the time. And when I went to juvenile hall and talked to the kids who weren't Buddhist in juvenile hall, you know, they were all suffering. And the only reason they even listened to me is because they were suffering, not because they wanted to be a Buddhist or because I was a Buddhist. And so the Buddha said, you know, I have figured out how to end suffering. And people wanted to hear about that. And so he said, suffering happens because we're born, because we get sick, because we get old, because we die. Suffering happens because everything is taken away from us through impermanence and change. Suffering happens because things are never the way they're supposed to be. We're always around people we don't like and in places we don't want to be. And that's the plight of being born as a human. So he continued and he said, but I have figured out why humans suffer so much. And the reason humans suffer so much is because they have desire and craving and a thirst that can be never be quenched. And no matter how hard they try, they fail completely. Because they can't see the world the way it really is. They are born with original ignorance, not original sin. And so he continued. And the answer to all this stuff is nirvana. Nirvana is the end of your suffering while you're alive right now in this very moment. Nirvana is the end of your karma and the end of all future rebirths. And that's sort of a philosophical thing. You can go there later. And then he said, I have figured out how to do it. I have walked the path. The path is the Noble Eightfold Path. It has been walked before by every Buddha that has ever materialized on earth. 27 before Siddhartha. were born on earth and achieved nirvana. Siddhartha was the 28th Buddha, according to the Theravada tradition. And so the next Buddha, the 29th Buddha, will be Maitreya Buddha, waiting right now in heaven, waiting to come down. As soon as the last Buddhist who knows the Dharma dies, he'll be reborn again and start the wheel of Dharma turning one more time. And you don't have to believe it, but it's a good story. I like that story. Eightfold Path: right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Eight path factors, not to be walked in order, but to be walked all at the same time. And these eight path factors slowly transform what we say, slowly transform what we do, and most importantly, slowly transform how we experience the world. This is a profound form of brainwashing. We say washing in Iowa. Brainwashing. And why do I say that? Because we're washing all the bad stuff and only have the good stuff left. We're getting rid of the greed and now we only have generosity, the hatred, now we only have love. We're washing all that stuff out of there. So brainwashing can be good, perhaps. And we want freedom. This is the ultimate freedom we're after. Freedom from suffering. That's the only kind of freedom the Buddha ever talked about. You know? So if anybody ever asks you, you know, freedom from what? Freedom from suffering. You know? Salvation? Salvation from suffering. It's always suffering. He did it. And now he left it for everybody who was interested. And people started to join up and become part of the Sangha. And the Buddha had to make rules. You know, first he had to get permission from your wife or your parents to leave, to join the Buddha. Can you imagine, you know, being a wife and then your husband just one day says, I'm going to join the Buddha and walk aimlessly around trying to find nirvana? Well, dear, how am I going to pay for the rent and the food and the children you've given me? You know, and he might say, well, I don't care because I'm going to get nirvana. And so the Buddha made all these rules that everybody had to be into letting their spouses go or their relatives go to join up. And then you couldn't be a monk if you were under 20. You couldn't be fully ordained. So they didn't want children joining either. But most of the people that joined weren't like ascetics and hadn't been practicing. They were like, you know, cobblers and farmers and they had no discipline. They didn't meditate. They didn't know what to do. So all of a sudden, the Buddha started making all these rules, which ended up to be 227 rules they needed to follow because that's how stupid they were. And maybe that's how stupid we are because we need all those rules too until we start to awaken to the appropriate and harmonious way to live in the world. Well, it was going along really good for 500 years, as the story goes. But you know, one of the problems in ordaining his stepmother as a nun, his stepmother who raised him became the very first nun, but he was warned if he ordained a woman, his teachings would die in 500 years. Well, you know, and so 500 years went by, and now everybody's freaking out because now the teachings are going to come to an end, you know. And so what did they do? Well, they started a new kind of Buddhism. They started the Mahayana tradition, the great vehicle, the religious form of Buddhism. And what the religious aspects of Buddhism allowed the therapeutic aspects of Buddhism to do is to continue existing. So the core philosophy teachings of the Buddha are like a tree, the core of the tree. And the religious aspects are like the bark of the tree, which protects and saves the core teachings. So the religious aspects of Buddhism are really cool because now we have bodhisattvas. We have the bodhisattva of compassion and wisdom, Manjushri, and they're there to help us if we get confused and get lost. And now we have something like Pure Land, which is the most popular form of Buddhism in Asia. And Pure Land is where you get to go to heaven. You don't even worry about enlightenment or nirvana. You just worry about getting to heaven. And Amitabha Buddha is the gatekeeper of Pure Land Heaven, and he will come down and escort you personally when you die to his heaven. And everything in his heaven speaks the Dharma. And you're guaranteed to become enlightened in his heaven. Well, You know, if you're an illiterate farmer growing rice, you know, and you can't go on retreat, and you don't want to, and you can't weed, and you can't have time to practice, going to heaven sounds pretty good, you know? So a lot of people now who are Buddhists just simply want to go to heaven. And we have 30 heavens and 30 hells, according to early Buddhism, but this Pure Land heaven is like the best and the coolest place to go. And why would that be so popular? Well, can you imagine, and a lot of you are younger than I am, and can you imagine being young and healthy and eager to taste the fruits of Buddhism, and you say, okay, in 20 years I'm going to be enlightened. And you go to every retreat you can, and you join your favorite center, and you buy all these books, and you even get a Kindle so you can carry it with you all the time. And 20 years goes by, and you are no closer to enlightenment than the first day you started. And you go, man, this really sucks, you know? So then you think, well, maybe nirvana. You know, if I didn't get enlightened, maybe I could achieve nirvana and just end my suffering and not worry about all the other people in the world who are suffering. And you spend another 20 years and not even close. So you got 40 years invested in your Buddhist practice, and you're no closer than you were the first day. And then somebody says, hey, don't worry about it. You can go to heaven. All you have to do is have faith, vow, and devotion to Amitabha Buddha. If you say his name 3 times with faith and devotion, he will come and save you when you die. Now you're 60, 70 years old, and you know what? That sounds pretty good, because you don't have much time left. And you can't sit like you used to, and you can't think like you used to, and you get confused a lot. But you can say Amitabha Buddha. That works. So in the beginning of our practice, it's nice to have that kind of, you know, confidence that it will happen. But as you continue, you might find it's not working the way you thought it was supposed to. And you know what? In a way, it's not supposed to work the way you think it's supposed to. Because what the Buddha said is you don't go find nirvana, you realize nirvana. And that's the catch there, that you are already enlightened, that you just haven't realized it yet. And all this practice you're doing are creating conditions necessary for you to realize that. So you can't go after enlightenment. You need to create conditions necessary for enlightenment to happen. And then you go, oh, okay, that's how it works after 20 years or 30 years. But what conditions are necessary? How many conditions are necessary? 10,000 conditions are necessary. Okay. Well, you know, how many of the 10,000 conditions are appropriately placed? Well, maybe 4 or 5. Okay. So I got like a lot of work to do, and I don't even know what the conditions are. I'm going to keep reading. I'm sure the Zen masters of old or the monks of old will tell me what the conditions are. But they can't tell you what the conditions are either, because each one of us is unique, has its own, we all have our own stream of karma, and our conditions for enlightenment are going to be different than Joe's conditions or Sally's conditions or Mary's conditions. We have our own specific conditions we need to become aware of. So then you might say, well, I'm just going to practice loving kindness. I'm just going to be kind. And that's about as best I can do. And that might be enough to get you to heaven. Cool. Now you're in heaven 100,000 lifetimes. You get to mellow out, enjoy all the merit you've acquired by being kind. You get reborn, you come back to earth one more time, you know? Look for that Dharma center, you know? Find that right book. And maybe you're going to go to heaven again. Or hopefully not go to hell again. And then as we keep going and going and going, then it happens. No guarantees. But all the while we're practicing, and that's the most important part of this little talk, all the while we're practicing, the most important thing we can do is to continue every day to be aware of how important this practice is. Because this practice is our salvation, this practice is our refuge when you become a Buddhist. Now, most of you probably, well, maybe I shouldn't say most, some of you may never proclaim that you're a Buddhist, and it's not necessary to be a Buddhist. Just be kind. It's okay. You can pretend you're a Christian and be kind. You know? or an atheist, or an agnostic, whatever you want to be. But kindness will allow you to suffer less, and surely everybody else around you to suffer less. We celebrate the birth and death of the Buddha. We celebrate both. We're so happy he was born, because when he was born, he achieved his full perfection as a human being, nirvana. And not only did he achieve that, he left his path the way he did it behind in the Dharma talks he gave. So we all have access to that. That's cool. But a really cool thing too is that he died. And why is that so cool? Because he never was reborn again. He figured out how to die and not have to go through all this crap one more time. So what happened to him, you might say? I think he exists right now in his nirvana. Nirvana is a brand new, unique way to exist. So Buddhism is not about nihilism. It's not about the end of everything. Buddhism is about how to exist without being born. And if you can figure that out, you'll never suffer again. And that's what the Buddha did. He figured out how to exist without being born. He wasn't created after his death as a Buddha. And therefore, he never had to get old, sick, and die again. Very cool. But everything that's created is going to die. And everything on this planet was created. We don't know by who. But everything was created. Everything had a starting point, and therefore it has to have an ending point as well. So we celebrate the fact that we can wake up in this very lifetime and die completely and not have any residue left at all. And that's how it worked for the first 500 years. But then the Mahayana made it a religion, and the Buddha had three bodies. He had his earthly body, and he had his cosmic body, and so he still exists someplace. And when I started to read about the Mahayana, I was so disappointed, because I thought it was so cool that he died. You know? But people don't want the good guys to die. They keep bringing them back. They'll resurrect them every time. The time has come for us to say goodbye and enjoy the day. So if I can, loving kindness meditation, to wish us all well on our journeys. May those of us who have come together today in mind and heart be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May our parents, our partners, our pets, our brothers and sisters, our friends and family, all the people we don't know, all the people we don't like, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May the suffering ones be suffering free, the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief. May the sick find health relief. Thank you all very much. And Holly, do you have...
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.